Okay, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and that damn music has me again, okay? Not damn music, because I really love it. It's something I grew up with that. That one song, that's all I listened to fanatically for about 10 years. It was just all the time, and now it's in my bone marrow, okay? And I just really need it to get going, and I really, I'm just going to keep playing it all the time. Teddy, keep that thing playing while I'm talking for a while, all right, man? Today's show is a very special show. We're going to be concentrating on the war on women, different aspects of it. At the back end of the show, we'll be taking your phone calls, okay? We'll be taking your phone calls on the whole situation. So get in line. Don't start calling right away, but be ready to speed dial as soon as we say go, okay? But before we get into the whole show, I want to let people know that if you are listening to the show sometime after it was originally broadcast, you'll be hearing us talk about calling us up to talk with our guest today. Well, you won't be able to do that if you're listening to it after the show was already broadcast. But you will get quite a bit out of the conversation that my guests have with the callers, so stay tuned. At the back end of the show, we're also going to be talking with Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper and one of the founders of StopPatriarchy.org. And she's going to be joining us to answer the question that she posed in Revolution Newspaper recently. How long do we have to suffer under all this? How long do we have to have this assault, this war on women? And we'll be talking about different aspects of that. And opening the show up, I'm very pleased to welcome to the show Savannah Badalich. Savannah, I'll just call you Savannah because I really like the name.
Thank
okay?
you.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. And Savannah is an undergraduate student studying international development studies at UCLA and the UCLA Student Wellness Commissioner.
Yes.
You're not going to arrest me, right?
That's no.
Not, okay. She's the health representative of 28,000 undergraduates. And after she was sexually assaulted by a fellow UCLA student and friend, she created a group called 7,000 in Solidarity, a campaign against sexual assault, a multi-campus sexual assault prevention campaign. Savannah, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Well, it's everything that we've seen in the last couple of weeks and actually the last month or so even with the refocusing on or even just the beginning focus on the prevalence of rape in campuses all across the country, the stuff that happened in Santa Barbara. I wanted to have you on because you've been in the middle of that for quite some time.
Yeah.
Basically, I wanted you to give us first off a sense overall because people don't know this. Even though that study that they put out recently that the government said, oh, well, we found out that 1 in 5 women will be raped or sexually assaulted in the course. Well, that came out initially 7 years ago.
Yep.
And people do not know what's the situation on the campuses. Give us an overview.
Well, the situation is that women and men are sexually assaulted on our campuses. And for the most part, they have either don't know where to go. They feel shamed in where when they talk to either a professor, an administrator, or their friends. So then they don't want to report their sexual assault. After that, if they do want to report, they have two avenues. The first one is to report through their university, in which many of the cases, like we saw at University of North Carolina or USC or Occidental, their administration is actually pushing them back, giving them excuses or for some reason even filing it under different crimes. So for USC, they filed a rape under injury response. And so that falsified their crime statistics, making them seem safer. And then you can go through police department, but the police department's not necessarily the most sensitive. Especially for students of color, they don't feel comfortable going to the police department or undocumented students, which is many students on our campuses, especially in California, are undocumented. So all of these problems in which universities want to keep their numbers low and then they look safer, which then makes parents who are college shopping want to go to their universities. So the only reason we're now having attention towards this is because survivors and activists actually know how to push back, which is suing or going through the Department of Education or Office of Civil Rights. And then once they start doing these federal complaints that make their universities look bad, then it goes from, oh gosh, liability management because we're afraid of this accused student of suing us to, oh my gosh, we look really bad in the media as if we're a rape haven. We need to go against that.
Well, it's interesting because in one of the things that you were quoted as saying, you talked about the fact that there's all this stuff that happens and that UCLA, for instance, is one of the only major universities in California that has not received a Title IX complaint, which has to do with one of the ways the federal government basically punishes colleges and universities for not providing an equal education to women and men in terms of sexual assault.
Gender, sexual harassment.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And it's a way of supposedly dealing with rape and assault, but not really dealing with it at all.
Yeah.
And you said that actually one of the things that happens here is that at UCLA, for instance, they keep talking about, well, even then, we haven't gotten it since 2000, and even then our numbers are very low. And you made a point that, well, one, you'd rather see the higher numbers because
yes.
you think that there's a basis for this, and two, that all that's happening is being proud of compliance and not actually, you know, so there's a hidden, what I'm trying to get at is there seems to be a hidden pool of people who
yeah.
are wandering around, damaged, abused, and
yes.
suffering.
Yes. So the way that universities have been going about is liability. So just trying to cover their basis and be in compliance with these two laws. The two laws that survivors are now using to keep colleges accountable are Title IX, and Title IX prevents sex discrimination. When you think of Title IX, you think of preventing a hostile reporting environment. So comments like, what were you wearing? What was your past sexual history? Under Title IX are inappropriate or technically illegal. And then there's Cleary. Cleary is the crime statistics. And Cleary, if university is falsifying.
Tell people what Cleary comes from, though, because I don't want to talk about this without telling, because we get into talking so much about laws and stuff, because this Cleary thing is based on a very real, terrible situation.
So Jean Cleary was a woman who was raped and murdered in her dorm room, and her parents advocated for the Jean Cleary Crime Statistics Act. And essentially, it mandates that all universities who receive federal funding, aka all universities, give out annual crime statistics. So universities want to keep their crimes low, which means sometimes falsifying their numbers by preventing survivors from reporting. I think of the state that we're in terms of college sexual assault, as a house. The floor is compliance with these two federal laws, where most universities, the 60 that the Office of Civil Rights and Department of Education came out with, are in the basement. They're not even at compliance. We want to be not even at compliance. We want to be in the attic. Like, there's no reason why we should just do the bare bones for survivors. And really, that's not enough for us anymore. And you really worry about having the accused sue. Well, what about all these students? 1 in 5 college women. At UCLA, that's roughly 28,000. Not 28,000. 28,000, that means 17,000 roughly are women, and then 1/5 of that. So 1/5 of those women may not graduate on time, may not have high GPAs because of their assault. And then that's not even considering the men that have been assaulted or those who don't identify as either.
So when you're looking at this and they're talking about 14 that they have on record, and you're talking about thousands of people who've been sexually assaulted. Now, one of the things I wanted to talk with you about, you have, and I want you to tell the story, because I think it actually says a lot. And I really want to move into some of the more, there's the visceral end of this thing too. And it's very important, I think, for people to understand. You had your own experience. You didn't just come to UCLA and say, okay, I'm going to fight rape. But you actually had a very terrible experience yourself. Walk us through that. What happened to you?
So some survivors are comfortable and some aren't. Just for anyone who's listening, I am comfortable with talking about my assault. So he's not just asking this out of nowhere. But yeah, so I am one of the 13 representatives at UCLA as a student government representative. And last year, about a year and now 7 months, 8 months, I was assaulted by a fellow friend. He was well-known on campus, prominent individual, pre-med, really well-liked. He was in my student government office as a higher-up, where I was just like lower as a sort of staff director, and he was amongst the top, and I don't want to give any more other details, mm-hmm. but we went on retreat, and it was for the office, and we were drinking. I went downstairs to go to sleep, so I was sleeping. I was also not really wearing anything provocative, if you want to put it that way, so me being asleep, me having closed the door, I was wearing my dad's old t-shirt and pajama bottoms, and he came in and he sexually assaulted me. Then the day after, when I confronted him, he told me I'm not that guy, and really he wasn't that guy. He's quote unquote nice guy, really well liked, well respected. He was my friend up until that point, so of course I thought he was a nice guy. He told me that no one will believe me. And in that moment I knew that was completely and utterly true, just because of the fact that it would have been his credibility against mine. I really loved the office that I was working in, and he was well respected in it. Had I reported, I probably would not be the student wellness commissioner. I really believe that. I know that if I reported, it would have been a hard process where I'd constantly be reminded until the end of either the university or criminal justice system process. So I decided not to report. Now, that had its consequences. I didn't talk to many people about it. And then halfway through during the year, I sort of hit my low point. I'm one of those people that have to constantly be busy. And so when I finally had like a period of time where I was by myself, I luckily had a failed suicide attempt. So the mental health ramifications of it still last with me. After I came out as a survivor and the Daily Bruin, and I've heard many survivors come to me about their stories or just been to speakouts, I've actually, about 3 months ago, was diagnosed with PTSD. Now, this isn't sad, but this is not a unique experience. Many other survivors experience this. Most survivors will know, college survivors especially, but most people that are sexually assaulted will know that they're a perpetrator, someone that they know or trust or are acquaintance with. So the stranger in the bushes trope and the thing that we think about with in terms of law enforcement, like why would you let them into your apartment? Well, they're my friend. Am I not supposed to let any of my friends into my apartment? So there's that. Why didn't I fight back? Well, I don't know how you were brought up, but I was told never to hit my friend. So and also in that moment, I was incapacitated in terms of drunk and scared that he was going to hurt me more than what he was already doing, because I said no multiple times and was held. But there's those things. There's the drinking. But it's not as though like me immediately taking a shot gives away my consent. And really, sexual assault and rape are the only crimes in which we use alcohol as an excuse for the perpetrator. I mean, if you go and rob someone and then you tell the police, well, I was drunk, they're not going to use that as an excuse. And so there's that, as well as like the whole, like, what about your past sexual history? What about you being friendly with them? What about what you were wearing? None of those really apply most of the time. We really think about it as you go to a party, you lead, quote unquote, lead someone on, you get too drunk. And then many times during the sexual assault workshops I put on, they've said, and I really love the fact that they voice their opinion, but many of the people in the workshop will say, well, what happens a bad hookup? What if you just regret it the next day? Or they might ask, what about false reports? And according to the FBI, only 2-8% of all reported sexual assaults are false. And only 40% of people that are raped or ever go to the police for criminal justice sake.
That's what I was going to say. What I gathered from my research around this, preparing for this show, it's actually the vast majority of women who are assaulted do not report.
No.
And part of it has to do with, as I'm listening to you and the reading that I've done on this. But first, before I say that, let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Savannah Budalich.
Budalich.
I thought I had it. Okay. Anyway, Budalich. And we're talking about rape on campus. We're talking about the oppression of women around this very particular, very barbaric, very dehumanizing and degrading, assault. And one of the things I wanted to ask you, though, is because as you're talking about all this, you're talking about it and I'm thinking, okay, there's the dehumanizing, there's the shaming.
Yeah.
And more than anything, there's the blaming the victim for this.
I mean, most of the ways that we've done sexual assault and rape reduction in the greater span of society since the 1970s anti-rape movement is risk reduction. What's risk reduction? That means, teaching these people don't go out and drink, go back around a certain time at night, like don't go out past midnight, walk with a friend, which, hey, if you walk with a friend, that friend might assault you. That's happened in many of the cases that survivors have come to me to talk. And we shame them. Why didn't you report? Why did it take you so long to report? So even if you report, why did it take you so long? Why didn't you go and get a rape kit? Why didn't you do this? Why were you drinking? Why were you wearing those clothes? Why were you flirting with him earlier in the night? Why were you doing, like, all of these questions that we ask are our own subtle biases. Like, and women ask the questions too. Women ask these questions, and I realize that the reason why they ask these questions to other women who are assaulted is because they don't want to believe that it could happen to them or happen by a friend. And just for any of the listeners, I didn't report. I wish I had, but that doesn't mean that any of you who are survivors, because I'm sure that there are some listening in, because that statistic is very high. Even if you don't report or don't say anything, you're still strong. I just want to say that because I'm, again, one of those people that talk about it, but many people don't talk about their assaults, even into adulthood. So It's just very, very sad. And I know that I went to a conference for college administrators called Sexual Misconduct Among College Campuses. And this was in January at University of Virginia. And the entire conference was on how hookup culture and alcohol led to sexual assault. Luckily, they let students give a Q&A or say statements, and I said that conflating hookup culture and alcohol consumption with sexual assault is absolutely missing the mark. Alcohol is used sometimes by an accused person to get the person into a state where they can assault them, but it never leads to it. The only cause of sexual assault, the only cause of rape, is assault or a rapist. It's someone's conscious decision to go against what someone wants or not to even ask at all.
I thought that was really important. When I ran across it, I thought, yes, that's exactly it. The cause of the assault is the assaulter.
Yes.
You know, and it's something that's really important in relation to this. And I wanted to say, and it's tied in with what I'm about to ask you, because you've mm-hmm. also talked about that there is a rape culture on campuses. Let's talk about that.
So rape culture, for anyone who doesn't know what the term means, is a culture in which we normalize violence against women specifically, but violence, sexual violence. So that could be, I totally raped that test. Or at UCLA, there used to be a set of stairs that ran from the top of these apartments down to Gailey, which is a street near UCLA. And at first, when it was first constructed, it didn't have lights or anything. So there were people that were assaulted on the stairs, and it became known as the rape trail. And so rape trail, if you were walking down it for whatever reason, you were assaulted. You were almost asked, why were you walking down rape trail? Opposed to, why did someone go there to assault you? And that's something specific to UCLA, but the whole, I totally raped that final, I totally raped that dude in COD, I totally did this and that, and talking, normalizing rape. Rape jokes normalizes rape. There's a difference between making a joke about rape and making jokes in which people are raped. There's a big difference. Because if you're making fun of the fact that people still rape, like Louis C.K. at one point had done a whole set on like how ridiculous it is that rape exists and that people are raped versus making a joke at the expense of someone else that's raped. So it's really like we try to do bystander intervention or try to prevent actions too late in the game. We try to, like, if you see someone being assaulted, stop it. Or if you see someone that's going to get hurt, stop it. Well, that's the escalated point. There, it starts from the culture we live in to prejudice that people build from that culture to discrimination to then acts of violence. If you're getting to acts of violence and you're starting to have that conversation, it's too late. Those people already have it in them. You can have that conversation after the fact, but really you need to start with when you hear someone say a sexist or rape or sexual violence joke and racist jokes. Because fun fact, intersections of race and class and all of those things can increase likelihood of someone being assaulted or not believed after their assault. But we need to really check people on these things. Otherwise, it's just going to continue to be rampant. But colleges do have that in which the shooter from UCSB said he was so surprised he was a virgin. Because he thought going to college, he would lose his virginity. Yes, there's lots of sex that happens in college. Yes, there's lots of partying. But those things do not cause sexual assault.
Right. There's a fundamental difference between rape and partying and people doing whatever they do. You know,
it's consent. It's really consent.
Yeah. Well, and it's also this thing about the rape culture. One of the things I kept thinking about and everything I was reading and some of the things that you were talking about is fundamental to that rape culture is the total dehumanization of the woman and the idea that that you are responsible for what happened to you.
Well, let's use the UCSB tragedy as an example. This individual, and I will not say his name, felt entitled to women. And because women did not have or would not have sex with him, he felt that the only repercussion for that was to kill them. So there was something wrong with them for refusing. And then if you look on internet forums right now, when they talk about it, they're saying essentially like, if you had just done this, no one would have died. So now you're just leaving like this ultimatum to women, college women, where either you allow yourself to be raped, which allow and rape should not be in the same sentence. They're two opposite things. You can never allow yourself to be raped, but either you are raped and you save hundreds of lives or you die. And so what does that end up telling us if we're giving people this ultimatum? You're not giving them a choice. And that just goes back to not considering them as humans and with their own agency, with their own decision-making skills. There's just like this idea that by being nice to someone, you should expect something back. And in terms of sexual violence on college campuses with women and students, they're somehow seen as culpable because they had agency to go to a party, because they had agency to make friends that are men or women, because women rape women. It somehow means that you deserve, like, you're so leaving your room, leaving the kitchen, anything that happens to you after that is your fault. And I think that goes back to when we talked about this prior to the show, is what you were saying, something about the fact that we're getting so much pushback from being seen as equal women, having equal rights under the law. But I think where the law is and where we are as a society, that societal norm is still grow. Like, we are still trying to get there.
Although there is that big, big sort of hovering there and covering everything. Let's talk about patriarchy, and we're going to do that in just a second. And I want to let people know that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we are talking today with Savannah Badalich.
Yes!
Okay, I knew I'd get it. Anyway, we're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, Sansara Taylor from Revolution Newspaper and StopPatriarchy.org will be joining us, so stay tuned. Take that to heart, all right? Take that to heart. Joining us now is, I should say, welcome back. We're focusing the entire program today around the war on women and particular aspects of it. In particular, we started off talking about rape on campus and the rape of women. And joining us now to talk about the war on women overall, and I'm sure we'll have some comments on, because she's been listening the entire time, is Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper, founder of StopPatriarchy.org, and a really frequent guest on this show, which I'm really happy about. Sansara, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. It's great to be with you. And Savannah, thank you so much. I've been listening.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, let's jump in this. By the way, you noticed that Leslie Gore did come back into the studio. She doesn't hold a grudge from you from the last time where we had to bump her for her song.
I am forever appreciative. I really am. There you go.
Okay. All right. I just thought you would appreciate that song, both for its meaning and its beauty.
Yeah, of course.
And everything else. All right, Sonny. So let's talk about this. You're one of the founders of StopPatriarchy.org and the initiative End Pornography and Patriarchy, the Enslavement and Degradation of Women. You've talked often about a war on women. Let's talk about that, including, you know, all the rape and assault, the whole culture it comes out of is part of a war on women. If there was ever a time that this fact is pounding at our collective consciousness, it seems right now. Can you talk about that in terms of putting this all within that context?
Yeah.
Big question.
It's a big one. I mean, I think as Savannah has been talking about, there is an epidemic of violence, terror, sexual assault against women. And this is one dimension. I mean, we are told constantly in this society that women have won their equality, that there's nothing holding women back, that, you know, sure, there's a few leftovers, maybe some economic discrimination, maybe a few dark ages, sexist, homophobes, and dinosaurs. But actually, it's not the case. We are living in a war on women. There's pervasive, constant, ritualized, everyday violence against women. There's the degradation of women. There's legal assaults on women's most fundamental rights, the right to decide for themselves whether they will have a child and when. If they're going to have one, they'll have one. An all-out war on women's right to access abortion and even birth control, so that huge parts of this country already are living in pre-Roe v. Wade conditions. Women are self-inducing. Women are being forced to foreclose their lives because they are being forced to have children they don't want. This is all happening now. And it's not just across the seas, it's not just somewhere else, and in fact, it's connected to that. This is patriarchy woven into the whole global and international system of capitalism and imperialism that we live under, and it's constant, and it's intolerable, and I am so glad that one of the things that really I found very important is in response to this UCSB shooting, which was a horrific thing, that women have actually broken the silence and come forward, as Savannah was just doing and as many others have been doing. But it broke into a much, much more center stage with the Yes All Women hashtag and other outpourings, where women were saying, and actually starting to understand themselves, these are not, if you believe and you've been bombarded with the notion that women have won their equality, then when you experience sexual violence, when you experience sexual degradation, when you're ridiculed, and your ideas are discounted, and all the other things that women face, you experience it as an individual problem. And some of what has actually come to the surface is that this is an epidemic. This is not an accumulation of individual or isolated incidents. This is actually taken in total a war on women in every sphere of their lives.
You know, one of the things, too, Sansara, that I was thinking about as I was preparing for talking with you, you know, this whole idea that what we've seen around in the aftermath of Santa Barbara, the whole idea of like somehow, OK, this is an issue of mental illness, which, OK, there's elements of that, but it's an aberration. It doesn't happen. You know, it's something that, oh, my God, it's like, you know, this is such an outrage or such a surprise. But this actually is not an aberration. When you really look at this in terms of the culture of the whole society and how it does come out of just what you've been talking about, the system and the patriarchy and the capitalism and imperialism and all the stuff that it does, that these are not aberrations. These are actually natural outgrowths of the way this system functions.
Yeah, I think that's true. I know earlier both of you were saying, and I think it's on one level it's very important and very correct, you were both saying the cause of assault is the assaulter. The cause of rape is the person who rapes. There's not alcohol doesn't cause it. Mental illness doesn't cause it. All these other things might be circumstance that mean somebody is more likely to act on to have their inhibitions lowered or have barriers that might otherwise prevent them from acting on their impulse to do so. But the impulse to rape is an impulse to dehumanize and violate and degrade and get off on the dehumanization and violation of a woman. So that I really agree with. But I think there's also, we have to look at this, why do we have a society? And I don't think that either, I mean, if you do disagree with me, that's fine. We should talk about that, but I'm not sure that you would. Why do we have a society that produces on a mass scale, men who rape? And I think that's a very fundamental question that we have to look at, because sexual assault, yes, it is the assaulter who carries it out and they make a conscious decision, or they make a decision at a certain point to violate a woman's desire to not have her body be used by that man in that way. But we live in a society and a culture where young boys are trained from a very early age through the mass media, through advertising, through pornography, which is rampant, that women exist for the purpose of sexually servicing men, that women's value is whether they're attractive to men, whether they are a hot sexual commodity to men, and that, frankly, once they're used in that way, that's all they're good for, and then they're garbage, then they're discarded, then they're sluts, then they're no good, then they're dirty, then they're all the things that women get called. We live in a society that continues, the virgin and the whore, it continues. It's incorporated into the structures of society. It's incorporated into the culture of society. It's incorporated to the ideology, the most fundamental things about how from day one, a girl is born and she's cute and she's pretty. She's cute and she's pretty, and people talk to her that way, and they dress her that way, and society does it. Even if parents intend to do something differently, this is the way society treats girls, and they treat boys in a different way. And that message gets internalized to girls, and it gets internalized to boys that this is what women exist for. And that is that and having a baby doll in your hand to become a mother or a breeder. And these are very, very entrenched parts of the culture and the fabric, and they have to be challenged, they have to be fought against, they have to be made visible, because they are so pervasive people don't even recognize that, they just take them for granted. They have to be made visible, but also we actually have to get rid of a system that continues to perpetuate this view that half of humanity exists to service men.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking right now with Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper and founder of StopPatriarchy.org. Sansara, you know, actually, I'm really glad you went in that direction, because that's actually where I was trying to go with that. And I wanted to ask you, connected with that, the significance on the other side of this, the significance of what has developed in the wake of what happened in Isla Vista in Santa Barbara, the hashtag Yes All Women, and what does that actually, to you, what's the significance of that? What's it mean in society in relation to this overall war on women and the rest of this?
I mean, I do think there's so much violence against women on this planet. There is such a vicious backlash. It's a patriarchal system that is built on the subjugation of women by men, but there is a backwards motion to this. There's a backlash against everything that the women's movement fought for and accomplished in the 60s and 70s in this country, from abortion rights to the way that the sexual revolution got reinterpreted. The right of women to participate in sex without shame got reincorporated into capitalism as a commodification and sale of women's sexual degradation, as opposed to women's self-expression or women's full humanity and sexuality as part of that. Women are now, in ways that never used to exist, stripped of their humanity, reduced to sexual objects, and degraded in the mainstream, in a more and more mainstream way. So this has gone on here around the world. There's the rise of gang rape in India. There's the rise of Islamic fundamentalism in large parts of the world. There is major changes going on in the ways that people live in every part of this world, and that's interpenetrating with the reinforcing and reasserting and violent reassertion of patriarchy in many different ways. So I know that's a big idea, and it's a little different than what you asked, but I'm bringing it up because I think that it actually underscores when people responded to this mass killing in Santa Barbara, and when women especially came forward and were saying, no, that's what I've lived through. Maybe it wasn't a mass shooting, but it was in my bedroom. It was in the backseat of my car. It was with my uncle. It was on the street. It was in my dorm room. It was when I was, thought my friend was going to walk me home to make sure I got home safely, but then he assaulted me. All of these things actually coming out and being made visible and being made a question that people have to deal with. We had protests around the country. StopPatriarchy.org did last weekend in response to the Santa Barbara shooting and to the mass violence against women. And it was one of the most heartening things, besides the women telling their stories, which was very inspiring and very strong and very important, were the young men who came out and said, a week ago I didn't know anything about this. Because it actually is the case, you can walk around and be surrounded by the walking wounded. You can be surrounded by the 1 in 3 women who've been victims of sexual violence or assault and not know it. And now it's becoming visible. And so these young men said, I didn't even know this, and now I see it, and I find it intolerable. And I think it's so important that this be made visible. But then we have to go further. We have to fight this. We have to speak up about it. We have to mobilize publicly against it. We have to look at the fact, frankly, this will continue to go on, and it will continue to go on. It has gone on as long as we live under a society that codifies and enforces class divisions and the oppression of women as a fundamental and essential part of that social organization, which is capitalism, its previous forms of society too. But we need a revolution, and this is something that people have to, at moments like this, I'll end with this, at moments like this, when people are opening their eyes to what is an epidemic, what is pervasive oppression, degradation, enslavement, humiliation of half of humanity, when that becomes visible, then you have to look at where does it come from and how do we end it? And that's a moral obligation.
Now, we have one more question, and then we're going to move into phone calls. But I wanted to ask you, you posed again, and you spoke to this about the point about how long, but you also, in terms of this war on women, there are various fronts on this, and you've been actively involved in taking this up. And one of the biggest fronts right now is around the right to abortion. You have something coming up that's in relation to that, right? In Texas, I think.
Yes. Okay, so this summer it really is a ground zero in the war on women. The entire criminalization, the terror against abortion providers, the criminalization of the procedure, making it illegal, criminalizing the women who miscarry in large parts of the country, who have ended up in prison. There's also abortion becoming more and more stigmatized and more difficult to access. And this has gone on around the country. We've talked before about 203 laws passed in the last 3 years restricting abortion, record restrictions in Texas, and clinic closures all over the country with really negative reverberations for women's lives. Texas, in particular, it's a state of 26 million people. It is enormous. To give you a sense, 2 years ago there was 46 abortion clinics in the entire state, and that was still not enough for everybody, but it was much better. By September this year, there will be 6 left if nothing changes, based on the restrictions that have been passed. So this really is a concentration of the foreclosing of women's access to abortion rights. And when women don't have access to decide for themselves when and whether they're going to have a child, it's a form of enslavement. Their lives are foreclosed. They're trapped in abusive relationships. Their plans for the future are just, they dry up. So, and they risk their lives to self-induce abortions, and that's happening too. So this is an emergency, and StopPatriarchy.org is mobilizing an abortion rights freedom ride, building on the one we did last summer across the country. This summer we're going down to Texas for the entire month of August. We're traveling through the major cities. We're going down to the Rio Grande Valley along the Mexican border, where really there's a high concentration of immigrant women, Chicano and Latina women, many, many women living in very impoverished conditions, third world conditions within the U.S., who have no access at all. The clinics in that region have been closed, no access to abortion. Right now, they have to make a 300-mile round trip twice to get an abortion, which most of them can't do. On September 1st, that clinic will close. It'll be a 600-mile round trip that they'll have to make at least twice to get an abortion. That's not real. This is unacceptable. And so people have to go down there. We have to mobilize. The laws are actually, they've been passed, but they're being fought out in the courts. So we want to go there and mobilize a kind of massive resistance that changes the political calculation of the courts and the politicians so that they've been ruling negatively. But so they start to fear what kind of upheaval, what kind of outpourings, what kind of resistance and disaffection will take place if they continue the negative rulings where they change their calculation and overturn these laws. It has huge stakes for women in Texas, but also for the whole direction of this war on women nationwide.
Mm-hmm. And the fight against it. That actually, to me, there's just this incredible connection between when you talked about the enslavement of women and its hookup with abortion rights and the denial of abortion rights. And you think about it, it's not a big stretch to go from, especially coming from the same root of the culture, the system, the society, abortion and rape. You know, this is not, and especially in the degradation and dehumanization of women.
Yeah, so, you know, go ahead. I want to say very briefly, I think you're so right because actually, having a child and having sex, they're two parts of being human, like the full humanity. Being in the world, having a social life, political engagement, all kinds of things, but including the sexual realm, the interpersonal realm, and if you choose to, having a child. And having a child or having sex are two of the most extraordinary things human beings can experience if they are voluntary, if they're on the basis of mutual desire and respect and equality. But if they are done against a person's will, being forced to have a child and being raped, they're actually two of the most dehumanizing, degrading, and violating things that human beings can live through. And I think they are very bound up together. And they are two different major fronts of the war on women, or on whether we're going to fight and bring into being a world where women are treated and respected as full human beings.
All right, Sansara, on that note, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sansara Taylor right now, writer for Revolution Newspaper, one of the founders of StopPatriarchy.org. We are also talking with Savannah Badalich.
Yes.
I got it. You know, I don't know why. You know, it's because you came in here and told me how to pronounce the name. You know, okay, so it's in my mind, Badalich. All right. So, and we're going to be taking your calls now. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to take your calls. You got questions, you got comments, you got ideas, give us a call. We're going to take a quick break and be right back. And let me remind you once again that if you're listening to the show right now, that means that you're listening to a pre-recorded version of the show, and you will not be able to call into the show and have a conversation with my guests. But you will get a hell of a lot out of the conversation that went on between my guests and the callers, so stay tuned.
An excitable boy.
right. Excitable Boy from Warren Zevon. Yep, that's right. Excitable Boy. That explains everything. All right, we've got some callers on the line. And let me remind you once again that if you're listening to the show right now, that means that you're listening to a pre-recorded version of the show, and you will not be able to call into the show and have a conversation with my guests. But you will get a hell of a lot out of the conversation that went on between my guests and the callers. We're talking with Savannah Badalich.
Yes.
And Sansara Taylor, and we've just been talking about rape, the war on women, the rest of this. All right, let's take caller number one, Carlos. Carlos, how are you?
Just listening to the last few minutes here. You know, the name of the institution is what? Stop Patriarchy, right? But doesn't that entail an empowerment of women and the emasculation of men?
Oh.
And also, doesn't that entail the more you empower women and give her all these rights, which, you know, I'm not against, really, but there's a severe consequence. If you look back at the women's liberation movement the last 50 years, they've been taken out of the home, and what's the consequence? The faltering of the family structure, the collapse of the family structure. The women is no longer around at home to take care of the kids.
All right, Carlos,
I'm all for a segment, a moderate, liberation of women, but I think it's going overboard.
All right, Carlos, we got the gist of your thing. You think that the fight against the oppression of women has actually had a side effect of the collapse of the family. Which one of you wants to jump on that one?
Oh, gosh. Sansara, do you want to? I feel like this
is your thing.
I think this is your thing.
Look, I think the family, let's just get down to blunt reality. The family, it's not, we're told it's like some cherished, romantic, perfect institution that people, God created, people came together, man and children. That is not the history of the family. It's not what the role of the family actually is. But there's a lot revealed. The root of the word family comes from the Latin, la familia. Its origins are in class and property relations. It actually means a male head of household and all of his living possessions. It refers to his wife, his children, and his slaves, over whom he has the power of life and death. That's the origin of the family. It came into being together with the overthrow of matrilineal and gathering hunting societies, the establishment of class divisions, of ruling classes and exploited, oppressed humanity, and the subordination of women and the control over women's sexuality by men as part of that functioning. And so today, it's changed a lot over the years. I won't go through all of this. You can find a whole lot about this in the Declaration for Women's Liberation and the Emancipation of Humanity at revcom.us. It's changed a lot, but under capitalism today, we still have the family is the most dangerous place for a woman or a child to be.
Yeah.
Look, I think it's horrific that a lot of oppressed nationality kids and poor kids in particular live in poverty. They live with women who are single mothers who are struggling, and that the children are a responsibility of all of us. So I'm not saying, oh, who cares what happens to the kids, but the idea that we need to reassert the patriarchal family, it was never good for the kids to begin with. It was never good for women to begin with. And I just want to say one other thing. The notion of emasculation, the notion that women being treated as full human beings deprives and denies men of their humanity is just not right.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, men shouldn't want to be slave owners. Men should want to be part of rising up against oppression. And there have been plenty of situations where especially black men, Latino men have been emasculated by the racist system we live under.
Yes.
But it's not been because of women. It's not been because of women. And frankly, we shouldn't be striving for men to be men. We should be striving for people to be emancipators of humanity, men and women with mutual respect and equality. And you need a revolution to get rid of the poverty and exploitation that leads to the children who are so left behind. You don't need patriarchy to be reestablished.
All right, let's go to line three. Isora, I hope I'm pronouncing the name right, who wants to talk about assault on campus. Isora, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. And first of all, I want to say that it's so important to speak about these things that are always happening. And I just want to make a comment about the last caller. You know, Carlos, you're missing the point. This is about we have to deconstruct the family structure and reconstruct it with the family as part of human rights, and that includes women. Mm-hmm. The other point I want to make is that I used to work at USC. I worked there for 24 years at the faculty. And Savannah talks about those people who are supposed to protect us are the ones that are the ones that take advantage. There would be these shuttles that would take us back and forth to our parking areas, and I would always say hello to them. One time there was no one on the bus. I'm walking to my car, and he says, oh, come on, I'll take you. Of course, you know, this is the person that is going to protect me. As soon as he closed the door and locked it, he jumped on me try to kiss me. And I'm a grown-up woman. I mean, I'm in my 40s, and I didn't even know what to do at that moment. I was so surprised. I froze, but, you know, it took me seconds to react, and I said, let me out, let me out. The door was locked. I ran to the door, and finally he got it, and I left. Did I report it? No. I was like, it's my fault because I'm always talking to Dan. Maybe he took it as I was flirting all the time. But days later, I realized I should have, just like Savannah, you know, time goes on, and I said I should have reported because I felt so violated. What right did he have that I trusted him? So that's all I want to say, and thank you for your show. This is awesome.
Sure. Savannah, yeah. Go ahead.
Thank you for saying that, especially over the phone. I know that was very difficult, but my God, thank you. I felt the same sort of questioning. He had been my friend, and I wondered, like, how many times had I maybe smiled a little bit too much, like flirted with him a little bit too much. And I mean, I didn't flirt, but had he perceived it that way? It is a question that we constantly ask, and then waiting, and then finally gathering the courage. By that time, you feel like it's too late. So thank you so much for sharing that, and I actually do know faculty at USC, so maybe I'll send them off a little comment about that. But that's amazing. Thank you again.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, let's go to line 4. Yulan wants to talk about anti-patriarchy. Yulan, how are you?
Hello? Language of rape needs to be improved to include the force of women to maintain a pregnancy they do not want. That is force against women. It is a species of rape. Mm. If you want to form any cause against the unraveling of Roe versus Wade in favor of these misogynistic groups, the force of women to have a child should also be defined as part of violence against women, which it is. And I think the definition of patriarchy, or the definition or the attributes ascribed to patriarchy, has caused the collapse of values in the United States and everywhere throughout the world. The language of violence against women needs to be improved so that fights can be more effective against it on all levels.
All right, let's hear from Sansara and Savannah on that one. Sansara.
Well, I really appreciate the comment. I really do. I think that forcing a woman to have a child against her will is turning her into an incubator. It's turning her into a vessel. It's dehumanizing her, objectifying her, and it is violence against women. It is a violation of her life, her body, her future, her hopes, and by a patriarchal society, whether it's done by the family, whether it's done by the church, whether it's done by the state, and especially when it's done by all three, which is what's happening right now. And so I think it's very important, especially a lot of people listening, especially a lot of younger people, a lot of people, yeah, I'm pro-choice, but they don't feel as strongly, as deeply about this as the caller just expressed. And I think we need to take her words to heart, because women who lived through the pre-Roe days, and women who are living in the border region of Texas right now, women who are in Mississippi where there's only one clinic left, they are facing the kind of violence and terror that she's describing. Yeah. And we have a moral obligation to turn this around and to not abandon those women. And we have to be realistic that if we don't turn this around, that will be the future for women everywhere. So it's important. This is not just a side issue. This is not just one issue among many. This is a central question of women's position in society, the fight for abortion on demand and without apology. So I really appreciate her comments on that.
Savannah?
I think that with the definition of rape being essentially, it's not a sexual act, but it's a forced sexual act without consent, I really go back to consent. Consent being a positive, unambiguous confirmation to something in terms of sexual consent that means to a sexual act sometime during a sexual activity. I think that with abortion rights, I think that unfortunately we don't listen to the women's consent. They aren't giving consent to keep the child. And that I do think if you look on the fundamental level between the definition of rape without consent and holding a child without consent, she's right. You can definitely form a word to then garner support. And I think that we should. I cannot imagine, because there's still some states when a woman's raped and carries a child and then brings that child to term and then has the child, the rapist can still have paternal rights on weekends, being able to see the child. And how disgusting is that?
Let's go to line one. Philip, who supports full equality for women. How are you?
I'm fine. That guy Carlos really got me going, man.
Good.
Hey, it's time for him to get into the 21st century, and time for equality for everyone. That's what I have to say.
All right. Thank you very much, Philip.
Yeah,
bye-bye. Bye now. All right, let's go to Jan on line three. Jan wants to talk about how rape denigrates the value of women. Jan, welcome to the show.
Hi there. This isn't about rape, but I'm in my 60s, and say 12 years ago when I was dating, I was amazed because many men said they wanted to meet someone, but I noticed when I was with them, they never asked me anything about myself. Very interesting. And at the end of the evening, they wanted to get all physical. So I just say there's a real lack of understanding in not all men, some men, that women are actually full human beings and that we're not here just to make them feel good. You know, like one man said to me, oh, I need to be nurtured. And when I said to him, what a coincidence, I need that too, he kind of scowled. So I think you get my drift.
Yes.
That's what I want. Not all men are like that.
All right.
Many men are looking for a quality relationship. But I just think too many men see us as, I don't know, service agents of some sort.
Jan, Jan, thank you very much. Sansara, Savannah, we have about 1 minute each, and then we got to run. Okay, so real quick. Sansara, you want to start?
Sure. Listen, one thing I haven't brought up that I want to make sure I say is that this violence and terror against women is not human nature. It's not the nature of boys or men. It is the nature of the system and how it socializes and trains boys and men. And it's not permanent. It doesn't have to stay this way. I do want to call on people. This is a moment to get into the revolution, to find out how we could put an end to all of this once and for all. I want to call on people to go to revcom.us, learn about the new synthesis Bob Avakian's brought forward, including on this question, a whole different approach to bringing the liberation of women as a driving force in making a real revolution, and call on people to join with StopPatriarchy.org this summer and going forward to stand up and raise our voices, to go from individual isolated outrage and horror to collective, powerful, undeniable, society-shaking resistance, because this has to stop.
Okay, Savannah?
Thank you for having me on. I just wanted to say, in terms of the last caller, when she said not all men, I don't think all men act like this. And I do agree with Sansara, who said it's mostly the structures and the society and the way that we're socialized. But maybe not all men act on these urges. Definitely not all men act on urges. 5% of men commit 95% of rape. But the complicity that people who don't speak up, you are allowing this to happen. So it may not be all men, but yes, all men should have a place in helping women. And yes, all men should have a place in ending sexual violence. And yes, all women experience some form of sexual violence. So I would like any of your listeners to go and look at the Twitter hashtag YesAllWomen to really understand what it's like. But thanks, everyone, for having me on. And I would ask you all to look at our organization, 7000 Solidarity, and any other organization that's happening on any other campus, because we're not alone.
All right. Thank you very much, Savannah, Sansara. Thank you very much for joining us today. And I want to let people know that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've been talking with Savannah Bodalich and Sansara Taylor. And we've been talking about the war on women and the various expressions of that war on women, from rape to the attacks on abortion and all other expressions of the oppression of women that this system brings down. And before we close the show out today, there's something I wanted to read to all of you from Bob Avakian, and it's taken from his book Basics, from the talks and writings of Bob Avakian, and it's in the third chapter. And I think it's really, really appropriate for what we've been talking about today. You cannot break all the chains except one. You cannot say you want to be free of exploitation and oppression except you want to keep the oppression of women by men. You can't say that you want to liberate humanity yet keep one half of the people enslaved to the other half. The oppression of women is completely bound up with the division of society into masters and slaves, exploiters and exploited, and the ending of all such conditions is impossible without the complete liberation of women. All this is why women have a tremendous role to play, not only in making revolution, but in making sure there is all the way revolution. The fury of women can and must be fully unleashed as a mighty force for proletarian revolution. Again, that's Bob Avakian, and it's taken from his book Basics, from the talks and writings of Bob Avakian. And you can go to revcom.us, and that's one of the spots where you'll be able to actually hook up with the revolution to find out what it's all about. You'll find the work that Sansara referred to earlier in the interview on the oppression of women and the fight for women's liberation, and it's called A Declaration for Women's Liberation and the Emancipation of All Humanity. You'll also be able to find out all of Bob Avakian's works on there, including his book Basics that you just heard from, but also a lot of the other work that he's done around both the oppression of women and the liberation of women, including most recently a compendium called Break All the Chains, Bob Avakian on the Emancipation of Women and the Communist Revolution. All right, so check all that out. You'll also be able to check out the newspaper Revolution there. I'm telling you, folks, you'll go there and you may spend the rest of your life just wandering through there and blowing your mind with all the stuff that you can find, all right? But check it out. That's revcom.us. All right, I want to thank all of my guests today, Sansara Taylor from Revolution Newspaper and StopPatriarchy.org, as well as Savannah Badolich from 7,000 in Solidarity and from UCLA. And I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And you can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. And if you want to, you can follow us. But remember, as I always say, please do it in a discreet manner. Don't scare me, because I do scare easily on that. All right? So anyway, follow us, write to us, let us know what you're thinking. And we're going to go out now with a song that I thought was very fitting for today's show, and that's Combat Rock from Slater-Kinney. Check this out.